My castaway this week is a politician's wife. She married nearly 40 years ago when she was a nurse and he an airline pilot. A devoted couple, they had three children. Her husband entered politics, where he became enormously successful. In 1984, they went together to the Tory Party conference in Brighton. They stayed at the Grand Hotel, where in the early hours of October the 12th, the IRA detonated a huge bomb. She and her husband were trapped for hours under tons of rubble. They survived, but she's been severely paralysed ever since. Today she surveys life from a wheelchair, but shows no trace of bitterness, simply an acute eye for the needs of those who, like her, have become the victims of sudden, terrible injuries. Although she can recall every moment of that awful night, I think it much better, she says, to look forward than to look back. She is Margaret Tebbit. It's an impressively positive attitude, Lady Tebbit, but let me ask you what is nevertheless a central question. Do you blame anybody for the position in which you find yourself?
No, I don't think I blame people. I don't completely forget or forgive, but one has to completely look forward.
And was that your attitude from the beginning, or have you had to work towards that attitude?
No, I think really from the very beginning I was angry, but not angry enough at times.
I remember the story was that the Queen came to see you shortly after, yes. And said to you, come on, Margaret, get angry, you should be angrier.
Yes, and I found it quite hard to be angry because I felt hanging on to life at that point and hadn't got any excess energy to devote to anger. And you could always see people in a spinal unit far worse off than you were. I thought I was 50 and lucky to have survived that long by comparison to some of the younger people there.
Well, there was even space for you to feel lucky, was there?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah. We always saw people really so much worse off than you. And at 20, it's a terrible thing to happen to anyone.
But it's that kind of attitude, I suppose, that lack of negative feeling that makes people invest you and people like you with noble characteristics, isn't it? They say that you're brave and courageous. You undoubtedly are, but I wonder if it quite feels like that coming from your end.
No, I think it's a case of getting on with life and being thankful that you've got a good family around you and lots of good friends. I have down days like everybody else. And I know I get angry with carers and lose my patience and all sorts of things like that. But, you know, to be positive is much more fruitful.
But has there ever been a moment or perhaps several when you felt that you might give in to it all and go under?
At times I felt quite depressed. And if I'd felt that I couldn't communicate with people, I know I would have ended my life if I could have done.
But it's the fact that you
it's
can think,
it's the fact
you
that
can
you
speak.
Can still speak and feel and love and live, albeit not quite like I would sometimes like to live.
Tell me about your first record.
First record is Glenn Miller and String of Pearls, which is just a marvellous time for dancing, albeit not with my husband. He's not a dancer. Glenn Miller and String of Pearls just brings back lots of happy memories of youth.
Glenn Miller and String of Pearls. What mobility do you have, Lady Tebbit? You can move your arms, I see.
Yes, I can take my weight through my legs if I'm supported and held well. I can move my legs in bed. I can kick my husband now, which is a great help. I can move my arms. I can take drinks and I can pick up some things as long as they're not too heavy.
But that's all quite new,
oh,
isn't
yes.
it?
Yeah.
How new is that? Because I know there was a time when you were really paralysed from the neck down.
Really, in the last 2 years, it's been the most improvement. But it's really been a long, slow battle with lots of physio.
So it's exercising, is it, that in the end results in...
Yeah.
So you haven't plateaued out. You could go on getting better, could you?
No, I was going to plateau out when I left hospital 9 years ago. So my consultant said then, he's taking it back now.
So do you set your sights on more and more mobility, or do you worry about that?
I don't worry about it in that sense. You know, I'm just thankful that I can take my own weight. I would just love to be able to lift myself off my bed onto a chair myself and to be able to take the odd step. But I don't visualise myself walking around or going climbing or anything like that again.
But what's the effect on your everyday life? You say you can just manage to pick up a glass or a cup, can't you? But, I mean, can you feed yourself?
Yes, I can feed myself. I can't cut food up, as my grandchildren say. Oh, you're very much better now. You don't make nearly so much mess. You know, that's great, very consoling from one's grandchildren.
Great swapping of roles.
Yes.
But can you put your makeup on? Can you do your hair?
I can put my lipstick on. I can put makeup on, but I need a lot of help with makeup because I'm too fussy. I'd rather carers or nurses did it for me than me make a mess. But I can put my own lipstick on.
Because Norman used to do that for you,
yes,
didn't he?
He was very glad when I could do that myself.
But how long does it take you to get up in the morning?
About 2 hours.
You can ride, though, I understand. You can you're put on a horse, you
can... Yes, I can sit on a horse, I should say. And it needs two people to hold me and one person to lead the horse as well. So it's not really riding in... You know, it certainly can't canter or anything like that.
But nevertheless, it must give you a sense of freedom.
And you're looking down on people, which is rather great.
I mean, it makes a change.
It makes a change, yeah.
And you can swim or you can stand?
I go into water. I use water a lot, but mainly on holiday because it's warmer in the pool and outside.
And you can stand up, then the water helps you.
Yes, and I can walk in the water.
Oh, can you?
Yeah.
Or you can actually make your one leg move in front of the other?
Yeah, but that's only in water.
But again, a great sense of
freedom. A great sense of freedom, yeah.
Obviously, what you describe is a great advance on how you were, but nevertheless, for a woman who before she was paralysed, didn't even employ a cleaning woman, the dependency that you have on other people must be deeply frustrating.
It is. I think that's the hardest thing, actually. I can't get to bed on my own or get up on my own or get my own meal or anything like that.
Or turn over in the night.
No, I'm getting better at that. My husband still turns me at night, but I am getting better.
And what about in your dreams? I've often read that people who are wheelchair-bound are not so in their dreams. You dream yourself fully
mobile. You dream yourself walking. You don't normally dream yourself in a wheelchair. I don't know about everybody, but a lot of friends have said that, which is strange, isn't it?
So you enjoy your dreams?
Yes, but they're like dreams that sort of... Sometimes you don't even remember fully and you can't visualise whether you were in a wheelchair or not. So I wonder whether, you know, it's your subconscious playing tricks on you again.
Tell me about your second record.
Ah, this is Kiri singing the aria from The Magic Flute. And this gives me great memories of one last night of the proms, which he invited us to. And that was a splendid night out.
Thank you.
Kirita Kanua singing the aria Ach, ich fühl's from Mozart's The Magic Flute with the Academy of St. Martin in the Field, conducted by Sir Neville Mariner. Margaret Tebbit, you met Norman 40 years ago at a party. He was a pilot at the time with BOAC. What were your first impressions of this man?
I think essentially fun.
He said himself in his autobiography that he was at the time, and I quote, feckless and irresponsible and not the marrying kind.
Oh, yes, very definitely not. And I wasn't either, actually. It certainly didn't enter into my head to get married.
So what happened? I mean, if he
What happened? He was friendly with stewardess, and I was friendly with someone else. So we both thought the other one would fill in time, you know. And then we realised we were doing an awful lot of filling in, and it sort of crept up on us.
But did you have a vision of what life would be like with him? I mean, apart from fun, could you tell that he might go places?
No, I mean, he was an airline pilot. He talked fairly early on about politics, but I thought nobody would be fool enough to give up a flying career to go into politics. I mean, he was great company from the word go. Life was not dull.
And he had the gift of the gab.
And he had the gift of the gab. So it was, don't know, what is it?
Anyway, it happened. Yeah. Your own background was happy, as I understand it, but humble. You were one of nine brothers and sisters, huge family. Mm-hmm. And you were training to be a nurse at the time. What did your family think of Norman? Did they think he was quite a catch?
No, I don't think my parents thought like that. He got on well with them. And I remember my mother being terribly impressed because he bought me a bunch of carnations from Rome, one for her and one for me, which she thought was fabulous.
So you were married, I think, 8 months after you met. Mm-hmm. It was quite a whirlwind romance, really, wasn't it?
And
you gave up your nursing to become a full-time housewife, and he went away flying a lot, but then you started a family, which I want to ask you about in a minute. But let's pause there for your next record.
Eartha Kitt. Just an old-fashioned girl, which was one of our first very few records that we had. And I can always remember, we still laugh about it now, we've still got the record. And we're playing it at different speeds. And the fact that you could get really long, low, slow Eartha Kitt, and then a really high pitch, as well as her delightful singing as well. And it always reminds me of mad times when you're very broke but very happy.
I'm just an old-fashioned girl with an old-fashioned mind. Not sophisticated, I'm the plain and simple kind. I want an old-fashioned house with an old-fashioned fence and an old-fashioned millionaire.
Eartha Kitt and Just an Old-Fashioned Girl. So it was after you had your third child, William, in 1965, that you suffered from postnatal depression. Can you describe what happened to you, Margaret?
It was within the first fortnight of William's birth, and I was just continually feeding him and losing track of time. So I was up day and night. I remember Norman went off flying, but I had girlfriends coming in, and when he came back, I just walked to the car and collapsed. And it's so often you keep up and then relief comes and then you go. And was taken into hospital just seriously ill. And I couldn't remember having had a child, or kept saying to him, you know, whose baby is this? And he'd say, this is our baby. You know, that's how desperate it can be.
He said that you were a potential danger to yourself and to the baby. Do you remember that?
No, I used to worry in case I had tried to, kill William, or, in fact, injure the other children. But you're so muddled, and it certainly made me have much more understanding of postnatal depression having gone through.
But can you shed any light on it beyond the knowledge of its existence and an understanding of what it's like? I mean, do you know what triggers it? What makes it happen? Where does it come from? Is it just sheer
exhaustion? It is a chemical reaction to things, you know, a hormone thing.
But in your case, it's something that stayed with you, because since then you've gone on having that kind of depression from time to time, haven't you?
But that was years ago. It came during the second election and again the third election.
So it's at times of stress that kind of depression
comes back again. But I know now I could feel if I was going off the rails, as I put it. If I go very high, I know it's a bad sign. That's as dangerous as being very low.
And you know how to control it, do you, with the right drugs?
Yeah, but I've been on drugs for a long time. But I don't suffer from it now because it's controlled.
But if you didn't take the drugs, it's there, waiting to come back in?
Possibly, yes.
I wonder if that's one of the reasons that you coped with your paralysis so well when it happened, that perhaps you have not just because of the presence of the drugs, but because you have an understanding of the kind of deep, dark holes that you can descend into.
I think so. That if you're physically ill, it's controllable. If you're mentally ill, it's not so controllable. I feel that having been mentally ill, I knew what it was to be unstable. And so I felt relieved that I didn't have that problem, that I'd only got the physical side.
You're not suggesting that you would prefer to be physically paralysed than to be mentally ill, which is treatable with drugs?
Yes, I think I am, actually. But if one had to make that awful decision, I know which of the two I felt far worse about. I know it's a strange thing to say, but I'm happy and I'm balanced now, and I know what it is to feel unbalanced and to feel absolutely desperate.
And that feeling is worse than it is to sit in a wheelchair, unable to look after yourself.
Yes, because you can't think straight.
Record number 4.
Morning Has Broken, I think. Cat Stevens, which is a marvellous song. And during the time I was in hospital, this was one of the songs that frequently came back into my mind.
Morning has broken like the first morning. Blackbird has spoken like the first bird. Praise for the singing, praise for the morning, praise for them springing fresh from.
Cat Stevens and Morning Has Broken. You must have relived that day in October 84 so many times, Margaret, not least because it had actually been rather a good professional day for Norman, hadn't it? He'd become the darling of the party. I think he got a longer standing ovation than Michael Heseltine. So you'd gone to bed happy, really, hadn't you? What was the first you knew? Because you were sound asleep, I think, when the bomb went off.
Yes, John Cole had been the last person to talk to us outside our bedroom. You know, I'd said, well, I don't know about you chaps, I'm going to bed, and sort of wandered into the bedroom. I sleep very deeply, and I can remember the curtains blowing and loud wind and things, as I thought. And then this enormous crash, and sort of Norman grabbing my hand, and we just fell and landed with the mattress over my back, I think. And I was sort of in the sort of fetal position, you know, sort of hands and feet almost touching. And a terrific amount of weight on my shoulders with rubble and things sort of falling on me. And just that sort of sensation of, well, just being crushed, really.
And where was Norman in relation to you?
He was quite near me at that point, but then there was another blast and he was blasted off across the room, and that was the really scary bit. I felt I could cope if he was there. And then I started to shout, of course, and he said, don't shout, there's no point in shouting.
But did you know what had happened?
Well, he said that's a bomb, or words to that effect.
And it was dark?
And it was dark. It was 3 a.m. And I said, how long do you think people will be in finding us? And he said, hours. And we sort of talked a lot, you know, about the kids and things like that, as you do.
And did you have any idea of how badly injured you were?
No, I knew my shoulders were killing me. And that's really where the worst injury has been for me. You know, you feel a lot of pain at the beginning. But then when I couldn't feel any pain, I realised what had happened.
What, you realised you were paralysed?
Yeah. Actually, it didn't fully register to me until my marvellous fireman came and said, "What? You know, who's that in there?" And I said, "Who's that out there?" I mean, it just sort of creases me when I think that you can be so sort of, you're high, really, aren't you? Still, I suppose. We're just delighted to hear somebody.
This was Fred Bishop.
Yes, this was dear old Fred.
The noble fireman who came to the rescue.
Yeah. You know, and he said, "Can you tell me anything about your injury, Margaret?" So I said, "My arms are cold." And I didn't want to say any more because I didn't want my husband to realise, because I realised, and I kept saying, "You must get him out first. He's having breathing difficulties," and they assured me that they'd have to get me out first, just the way we were.
But because your hands were cold, you...
Yeah, my hands and my arms were cold.
So your nursing training, yeah. I suppose, told you that there was a problem.
Just showed me that something was adrift.
How long did it take them to get you out, do you know?
Oh, just minutes, really, I think. I don't know. Time stands still in situations like that. You can't really remember. I remember him saying, "Oh, pass me a collar." It was when they said, "Pass me a collar," that I realised they were trying to immobilise my spine a bit.
But did you also fear that Norman was in a worse state than you?
Yes, I was more worried about his breathing. But that's the nursing in you, you know, that makes you always think you know how to deal with the chap.
Perhaps it's the wife in you as well.
Oh, a bit of that, I expect, yes.
And then you were out and you were taken to hospital where you were to spend the best part of the next 2 years, really.
A year in Stoke and then a year in Stanmore.
Tell me about record number five.
Harry Secombe, who I admire terrifically, actually, and his voice as well as personality. And God be in my head, I think I might need it.
Harry Secombe and God Be in My Head. You cope with life in a wheelchair, Margaret, by having full-time carers, as you said. Two of them, I think, round the clock. Mm-hmm. So there's always somebody there if you need them. Mm-hmm. But as I understand it, there's been a string of such carers. They change quite frequently. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, at the very beginning, I needed a lot more care. So they tended to be nurses then. A lot of them are travellers who are coming here and going on to travel anyway. And then gradually, we've introduced girls who have not been qualified, but as carers.
But you employ, as you say, in the main, people who aren't English. They're New Zealand or Australian or South African.
Just happens.
Does it? Or is there some implication that the British don't train people so well for these jobs?
I'm always hesitant about criticising, really, any training that's given. But I do feel that we've rather lost are practical nurses like ward auxiliaries and enrolled nurses. I would like to see introduced back into the community girls of the equivalent of the auxiliaries and the enrolled nurses who don't need to do university training to really overlap with people when they come out from hospital, because you do feel desperately alone then. And it would be good. I can't understand why we can't have a system where we train carers in the hospital and they come out with somebody. Then they go back to the hospital again to go out with somebody else.
Other disabled people might say that you're lucky to be able to afford private help, mm-hmm. and I'm sure you'd agree, and it must cost hundreds of pounds a week. Mm-hmm. So often in ordinary families, it has to be, you know, the husband who looks after the wife or vice versa, doesn't it? That must be very damaging to the relationship, don't you think?
Well, I feel it is, and they shouldn't have to feel that they have to do it. I know they don't feel they have to do it. But I would like to feel that we had carers trained who could give those people, which either spouse it is, some help by relieving them.
Of course, you were paid quite a lot by the Criminal Injuries Compensation Board, weren't you? I'm sure you know now that a ceiling has been put on what people can be paid out, and that ceiling is $250,000. Mm-hmm. How do you react to that? Could you have coped on that sort of money?
You do spend a lot of money a week if you're doing it the way I'm doing it, or the way that most people do it.
Do you think it would be better if there weren't a ceiling on it, that you
can't? Well, I don't know. There are so many ceilings being put on so many things, because after all, it's your tax and my tax and everyone else's tax that provides for us when we are injured. It's very difficult.
It is difficult, isn't it? Because people will look at your case and say, well, you know, she received a lot of money because she is who she is. The Tebbits are who they are. It's all right for them.
Oh, I know. I'm well aware of that, which is why I would like to feel that perhaps with some of the ideas of carers and just drawing attention to things that can be helped along, that we're putting a little bit more back into society again.
Next record.
Ah, the Trumpet Voluntaries. This is really as a reminder of all those marvellous royal occasions, particularly the one in Westminster Hall, the Silver Jubilee celebrations. A fantastic experience.
Regimental band of the Coldstream Guards playing Jeremiah Clarke's Trumpet Voluntary. Life staring at people's midriffs rather than into their faces, Margaret, must be quite difficult. What do you want people to do? Do you want them to stoop down beside your wheelchair, or do you want to look up at them? I think people are rather stumped as to how to behave, aren't they?
I don't want people to have to stoop down to me. But, no, I think as long as people realise that you can't possibly hear what they're saying, if they don't talk clearly and to you when you're in a wheelchair.
What, because you're at a lower level?
Because you're at a low level.
It must also give you a terrible crick in the neck.
Yeah, I mean, you're not being distant when you're in a wheelchair, when you're looking a bit vacant. It's because you don't really want anybody else to talk to you up at that level, because it is very difficult to, as you say, sit there like that. Hmm. And I like people, if they want to sit down, you know, draw up a chair and sit down. That's why I enjoy having friends in to dinner.
Because then you're all sitting down.
Because you're all sitting down. And they all say, no, we don't know, you're in a wheelchair, sort of thing.
What sort of people are, can I ask you, worst at coping with it? I mean, are there sort of certain sorts of people who just get completely thrown?
No, I think it's all sorts of people that get thrown for various reasons. I do think you're a bit of a social misfit in a wheelchair. Very difficult for some people to find, even if their house is perfectly suitable, and you know it is, who find it very difficult.
But people did sort of drop you, didn't they, afterwards?
Oh, some people do, but you make new friends. I mean, the acquaintances, so many of the friends who are closest now were only acquaintances.
But they turned out to be better at coping.
But they were marvellous at coping and putting themselves out.
But why do you think there were those who couldn't cope? People who've
been good
friends.
Because they're too busy socially. Because they're not really good friends, are they? But it doesn't bother me. There's always another good friend around the corner.
What, so they would find it an embarrassment to have you to dinner?
Yes.
Or they just think it's all a bit too much trouble?
A bit too much trouble, yes.
Quite depressing, that.
Yeah, well, but people are depressing sometimes, but they're always nice people as well.
More music.
Ah, Frank Sinatra and My Way. Well, I mean, it's self-explanatory, really, isn't it?
The record shows I took the blows and did it my way.
Frank Sinatra and My Way. You have 5 grandchildren to date, Margaret Tebbit. Mm-hmm. And I suspect, as you say, they cope with your being in a wheelchair better than anybody, don't they? Mm. Is it right they call you Chair Bear?
Yes, 3 of them call me Chair Bear.
What about Standing Bear? What about Grandad Norman? I mean, I'm sure he's an old softie with them.
Oh, yes, yes. He adores, particularly being down in Devon with them.
But I have to ask you, I mean, what's it been like living with somebody who's been publicly described as a semi-house-trained polecat?
Oh, you laugh about it mostly. Sometimes you get annoyed about things like that. And it's always amusing to be with him shopping or something and somebody will come up to him and say, "You're a much nicer chap than I thought you were," or, "You know, I did enjoy what you were saying the other night."
But have you always been amused, or have there been times during his political career that you said, "Norman, you've overstepped the mark there. You were just a bit too rough there"?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There have been often times when I've said that. But then most wives do, don't they?
And he doesn't take any notice anyway.
And he doesn't take any notice anyway.
Let me ask you finally about your desert island, because you say that in your dreams you can walk. Mm-hmm. And this, after all, is a dream island we're sending you to. So what are you going to do there?
Well, if it's really going to be a dream and I can step off a magic carpet, it would be marvellous for me to be able to walk on the sand again, because I haven't done that for 10 years, 11 years, to find shells and plants, I hope. That would be the thing that I would enjoy. Just walking, actually, and climbing and going into rock pools and putting your toes in sand.
Last record.
Julian Lloyd Webber with the cello, because it's gentle, soothing. Also, William did start to play the cello, so it would be a reminder of what he ought to have perhaps stayed at a bit longer.
Julian Lloyd Webber playing Evert Tauber's Nocturne with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Cleaberry. If you could only take one out of those 8 records, Margaret, which one would it be?
I think it would have to be the last one, the Julian Lloyd Webber, because it would repeat much more. I wouldn't get so bored with that, I think.
What about your book as well as the Bible and Shakespeare?
I think I'm going to take the Royal Horticultural Society magazines, bound with Hillier's Dictionary of Plants, and that would keep me occupied. And I could really read it from cover to cover, which I swear I'll do, and never seem to get round to it.
And then you have to choose a luxury.
Well, I'd like really the magic carpet, but
but you can't have it.
I can't have it. And as it's really a fantasy world, I'll stay with the idea, I think, of having the team of Manfridis, because I couldn't possibly cope on an island without some help.
So it's an endless stream of man fries.
It's an endless stream of man
fries. To put your makeup on and turn you over in.
Yes, that's right.
Margaret Tebbit, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Islanders.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you.